we're here today with two friends and also former guests of this podcast, two of the most informed specialists in international law that we know, to talk about a question that has been bubbling around now, almost since the very beginning of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, leaving aside the prior annexation of Crimea. And the question has to do with the vast amount of frozen Russian reserves that are currently stuck in kind of perpetual limbo in the West in various ways and in various countries, and that are sitting there kind of temptingly offering a means to compensate Ukraine for at least part of the damage that the invasion has caused, to finance Ukrainian resistance to the Russian invasion, maybe to finance some of the reconstruction that will eventually need to happen. And there has been a kind of great appetite for freezing those assets in the West and very little appetite for confiscating those assets. And in various Western governments, almost pathological aversion to taking those assets and simply handing them over to the Ukrainians to use for reconstruction and for war finance. And there have been a number of proposals designed to kind of get around that reluctance, to at least solve some of the legal problems that people have raised to object to an outright confiscation of these assets. And we wanted to talk to Ingrid and Paul today to get a sense of kind of where the legal pitfalls lie and what sense we should make of the various proposals that are out there. So Ingrid, Paul, thank you so much for joining us. I have a kind of kickoff question, but first I just wanted to say we're really thrilled that you're here.
Happy to be here.
Thank you so much for having me.
So can we talk about this recent proposal that I associate with Lee Buchheit, but that is in fact presented alongside a couple of co-authors, including Dilip Singh and Hugo Dixon, I think perhaps is the third. But this proposal has both the advantage of recency and I think is being taken with some degree of seriousness by folks in the U.S. government and elsewhere. And so maybe, Paul, if I can start with you, can you kind of sketch out the basics of this proposal and the problems it's trying to solve?
Sure, happy to try. So the basic problem from a U.S. law perspective is that there does not exist authorities in the executive branch to simply confiscate the assets and send the money off to Ukraine. Absent some action by Congress that solves that problem, the idea is how can we work with the legal tools we have to get to that outcome? And the thought is, and I might add, there's a secondary concern, which is that there are judgment creditors with claims against Russia out there. And there's some worry that the judgment creditors with substantial arbitral awards, we're talking about claims that sum up to close well, more than the amount of money that we've frozen. Want to be sure that the money goes to Ukraine rather than judgment creditors, even though some of the judgment creditors, not all of them, are Ukrainian state-owned enterprises. The idea is lend the money to Ukraine, collateralize the loans with Ukraine's legally existing now claims for reparation against Russia for breaches of international law causing severe damage. See the International Court of Justice, U.S. Nicaragua case. and have the United States set off against those claims when they mature the amount that we are holding in just a basically erasing our amount owed to Russia for the ultimate refund of it of its assets against the money will Russia will own us based on our acquiring as collateral the Ukrainian claims. This is assuming, of course, Ukraine will default on the loan that would be anticipated, therefore transferring the reparation rights to us. And the thought is that a set off is not a confiscation and can be done under existing authorities. The only wrinkle is where do we come up with the money for the initial loan? Do we make a provision against the frozen assets for that? Are there existing legislative authorities for loans that are different from outright transfers, which is the issue that Congress is hung up on right now? So that's a wrinkle that has to be addressed. But in theory, the set off gets around the current lack of authority to forfeit and claim the Russian assets under U.S. law.
Thank you, Paul. That was beautiful, and you also helped set up the big questions that have to be answered, at least some of them. So I'm hoping we'll come back to you on the question of how do we actually get the authority to lend the money? And I imagine that's a question that has to be answered separately in each of the countries that we envision participating in this syndicated loan to Ukraine. But I have a threshold question that maybe is trivial to both Paul and Ingrid and Mark as well, since Mark writes about sovereign immunity, but I know squat about sovereign immunity. And my understanding, and Ingrid, if I could turn this to you, my understanding is that most of these assets are in central banks in the West, or at least some of them. And those assets have strong immunity protections, I would think. So can one get them? Can one just say, by just saying, sprinkling the pixie dust of the set off, now we can get these assets, whereas previously we could not get the assets? I'm totally confused. Ingrid, might I ask you?
Yeah, no, thank you. And let me just use your question to set out a couple of larger framing remarks. You're right that most of the assets, I think most people think we're talking about $300 billion in assets. Most of those are actually in the EU, not in the United States. I think the US, Paul, you can correct me, but we're talking something around 50 or 60 with significantly larger amounts of the assets in the EU. So the EU is and you know, because we're talking about such astronomically large damages against reparations from Russia, the money in the EU is really important, and they have been a very important player here. I'd like to talk more about the proposals in the EU to tax the money, to use a windfall tax to get some of the money in the hands of Ukrainians. But on your specific question about immunity, yes, the assets that we're talking about are central bank assets, and they are entitled to a very high level of immunity under international law. They are different from oligarchs' assets. They are different from other kinds of sovereign assets. The immunity to which they are entitled is best understood as an immunity from judicial measures. That's what foreign sovereign immunity is. And so I think there are two kinds of questions that the proposal that we're talking about are designed to overcome. Right. One is, you know, to who is the money owed? It's a problem if the United States seizes the money, but it's actually owed to Ukraine. So some of the proposals, this is a way to make this be a debt to the United States and an obligation owed to it. That's kind of one bucket of problems. And then the other bucket of problems is, you know, how do you actually like legally get the money from the Russian central bank's bank account, you know, into somebody else's hands? And this is a little bit technical, but again, immunity is immunity from judicial measures. And almost always in the US, we need some kind of court order or judicial intervention to change the ownership of property. And some of the legality of this depends on whether it would involve a court issuing a turnover order or whether it's something that can be concluded entirely by the executive branch without a court order. That was a lot. So I'll stop there. And I don't know which parts of those you want to hear more from me on.
So can I ask? Oh, sorry, Mark. I just had a little follow up. Do you want to go or shall
I? No, go ahead.
Okay, so it almost seemed like you were about to give us an answer, Ingrid, in this, or at least an answer to one of my questions, but then you stopped short. So like, I'm gonna ask this extension, and maybe I'm making a connection that's not there. You talked about how there's sort of there's a difference between the judicial branch and the executive branch in this. And is there any constraint on the executive branch doing the set off? I mean, I'm just asking for clarification. It seemed like you were suggesting that the executive branch might have greater authority.
I do think the executive branch has greater authority. We are definitely getting into some very uncharted territory in
it. Oh, goody. I love that.
So let me respond again with a big picture answer to part of it. A lot of people say, like, what is the problem in international law? After all, we all know that Russia violated international law. We all agree, as I do, that Russia owes reparations to Ukraine. This is easy. We just take the money. I just would like to remind listeners, that's actually not how legal systems work. Right. If your neighbor violates the law by parking his car on your yard and it's right there, everyone can see that violation. Everyone agrees that is a trespassing. You don't get to go into his home and take his family photos or, you know, pick which of his valuable objects you'd like to have and take it back home. That's just not how legal systems work. And so an international law doesn't work that way either. Just the fact that Russia owes reparations to Ukraine and just the fact that Ukraine can transfer that obligation to the United States in some way doesn't make it necessarily lawful for us to use self-help measures to enforce that. On the executive and judicial, again, let's start big picture. If another country, invades and takes your central bank assets with a tank, well, that might violate a lot of parts of international law, but it's not an immunity problem, right? And so the immunity again is designed largely for judicial measures. What is really difficult with administrative type of processes is we do get into some really interesting questions about where does executive authority end and where does something that we would inherently call judicial authority begin? And there aren't a lot of great questions. Answers to those difficult areas. And I think we're in one of those. Paul, I'd be interested in Mark. I'd be interested in your views on that.
So Ingrid, everything I know about this, I've learned from you. and the only things I can add is, I think the issue is exactly what kinds of self-help does international law and domestic law tolerate? We know areas outside of state-owned property where we accept self-help without any intervening due process. Think of, repos. And the idea is that set-off is like that. It's a commonly used form of self-help. The party that has been paid the cost of self-help, has rights to retrospective judicial challenge, but they have no right to prior process. And arguably, international law with respect to state-owned property works the same way, especially if the state-owned property is parked outside the territory of the sovereign concern. I mean, there is an argument that when you move your stuff into another country, you accept, at least for international law purposes, you accept the risk that your host may turn on you. What protection you get from domestic law. And I think it's a reasonable interpretation of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act that the protections central banks enjoy under that statute are against a judicial process of execution and collection, but a set off, arguably not. But it's never been tried, so we don't know.
So if I can ask one more question along this line, or Ingrid, did you have something you wanted to say to follow up? I'm happy to shut up and listen.
Just a one sentence, Mark. On this, you know, countries kind of accept the risk with respect to parking their assets abroad. I really think the global financial system is in large part based on the idea that that's just not true for central bank assets. These have, in a world in which countries disagree about pretty much every international legal norm, the idea that you can park your central bank currency reserves in the Fed in New York, and your risk that they will actually be confiscated is close to zero. I would just slightly push back, Paul, on the idea that all assets parked abroad, countries expect some level of risk. Sorry, Mark, that was more than two sentences.
No, that's super helpful. I think we may wind up transitioning onto other aspects of this conversation, but I'm still hung up on the intersection between the domestic law of foreign sovereign immunity and the international law of foreign sovereign immunity here. And I guess part of what I'm struggling with is that if we set aside and what would have to happen as a matter of the U.S. legal system, or national or supranational law is governing the process that would have to be followed before these assets could be the set off could be triggered. Set that aside, and just think about what international law would have to say about the confiscation or set off of these central bank assets. I feel like the claim that would be the predicate for the set off, this claim for compensation or reparations or whatever it would be called that Ukraine would have against Russia, I feel like that claim and the mechanisms for enforcing it are just really far removed from any of the concerns that animate the international law of foreign sovereign immunity. Does that make sense? You'd have like an ICJ judgment that would quantify the claim, and then there'd be activity in the UN Security Council to try to enforce it. And it just, this is not the kind of claim that I would think would naturally trigger concerns over foreign sovereign immunity law. Am I thinking about this wrong?
Yes.
Thank you. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, well, you know, so you have a very valid point. And I'll let Ingrid jump in on this too. But I just, you know, first of all, the ICJ has nothing to do with any of this. There's no jurisdiction there. So the issue is whether you can get a disinterested, seemingly proper international tribunal. And that's what been part of the proposal that Lee and I have floated. And we think that helps clean things up a bit. But I don't think it is a prerequisite under international law. The issue just would be to what extent are central bank deposits protected by international law from valid claims, and perhaps the top of the hierarchy of validity would be adjudicated international law claims. But I you know, just you know, it's very fair to say, as Ingrid does say, that you know everyone protects central bank deposits. You know, that's unarguable. I think the issue is whether a coordinated behavior is the base on self-interest, or rather an international norm that states obey even when their interests do not coincide with that. And, you know, every state would like to be the holder of central bank deposits. In the U.S., more than any other state, we have compelling economic interest for providing maximum security to foreign central bank deposits. The only issue is whether that interest is reflected in a international law norm. And one argument is behavioral regularities point to the existence of the norm. And the contrarian argument, which I have a taste for making, is the national signal is even stronger if it's not based on an obligation to obey international law, but we make a choice to provide strong protection. But, you know, that's very much up for argument because we haven't actually seen anyone do this.
So let me, I can't believe it. We asked you one question, I think the big question, but we're already halfway or more than halfway through our podcast time. So I want to try to ask at least a couple of the other questions that have been bugging me. And please don't hesitate to tell me that these are really easy questions that we shouldn't spend time on. So one of the predicate questions that I've had, that this proposal, as so much of Lee's work is clever, elegant, and counterintuitive, at least to me, but it seems to be predicated on some kind of international tribunal recognizing, articulating, deciding that massive amounts of reparations are owed to Ukraine because of Russia's bad behavior. And the Security Council, presumably, is never going to do this because we have this ridiculous system as to how the Security Council is set up. And the General Assembly might issue stuff, but we have no tribunal yet that has issued any sort of indication of how much is owed in reparations. And I'm guessing, Paul, you've dealt a lot with the Russians. I'm guessing the Russians have lots of lawyers who are going to make arguments about how nothing is owed and how Ukraine's really owned by Russia, and Russia is, you know, I don't know, saving the world from the Nazis or whatever idiotic stuff that Putin has been saying. But I mean, don't, for any of this to work, do we need an international court to say, you know, $300 billion is owed in reparations or $500 billion? I throw this to both you, Paul, and to Ingrid.
Well, let me jump in first, and Ingrid can correct me, as I'm sure she will. You know, there's no bulletproof solution because there's no way to get Russia on board with this system. I mean, I don't think Russia would submit to the jurisdiction of anybody. Putting aside, you know, it certainly would have legal claims that it owes nothing, that it's simply exercising the rights of self-defense. At least that's what it said in the past. So the issue is whether it's possible to construct a body that will have enough legitimacy that other important players other than Russia, say China, say India, say South Africa, Brazil, will give it a pass, even if they won't enthusiastically endorse it. And if that's your goal, what does it take to come up with a, you know, to construct something? You know, the templates for the United States are the Algiers Accord and the U.S.-Iranian Claims Tribunal, where, you know, it was only the two countries, but they settled between themselves. They created an ad hoc body that has done a pretty good job of setting price to the claims, and then it's self-enforcing for reasons we don't have to go into here. And it's not perfect, but, you know, it's a reasonable way, I think, of, you know, keeping things, blunting the most extreme claims Russia might make and the full extent of sympathy that the countries that are, if not friendly to Russia, at least somewhat sympathetic to Russia, would embrace. I mean, we're never going to make the Cubans, the North Koreans, the Nicaraguans happy no matter what we do. But if we can get, you know, China, India, Brazil, South Africa on side, that's pretty good.
I agree entirely with Paul. I just want to, you know, add that the general precedents, and this is consistent with what he just said, that are cited in this area occur either, me too, as you've already suggested, through a UN Security Council resolution, which we're not going to see here, or, you know, the most common way we divide up reparations post-war is through some post-war treaty or agreement. And this is the consent to which Paul alluded. We've never had a situation where we sort of decide ahead of time who's going to pay reparations and what that's going to be, and then divide that money up you know, ship it out and pay people. The U.S. Iranian Claims Tribunal, which I agree did a great job, that is set up, you know, after the fact, if you will. And so, you know, part of what's happening here is this effort to use a loan to sort of push the entire transaction forward. As many people have noted, this makes it not seem very much like a countermeasure, because we're not using it to induce different behavior by Russia. We're using it to compensate people who have been harmed, and those have been at odds. Mark, your earlier question, the difference between the International Judgment and the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, you're right, they're on different planes, but, you know, the question is how you get money into somebody else's hands. And even if an international judgment says that that should happen, you usually need domestic legal mechanisms, not always, but usually in a democracy, you need a statute and a court to make those judgments have an effect. And that's where the two come together, I think.
So can we, I know there are other mechanisms that we had wanted to talk about, and Ingrid, you had talked about some of the other proposals that were out there, but I just have sort of a practical question, since it sounds like we're in the terrain anyway. And so we're already, of course, in a situation where these reserves have been frozen, for all anyone knows, effectively in perpetuity. I mean, I think in principle, one can always say, well, they're frozen in the hopes that there will be some kind of post-war settlement an agreement regarding the disposition of those assets. But, you know, it's not clear to me, at least, whether that's ever likely to happen. And now we're thinking hard about ways to kind of formally justify a transaction of the sort that Lee and his co-authors have proposed. And I guess I'm struggling to understand why this agreement has gotten as much, why this idea has gotten as much traction as it has. I mean, given the reluctance to do anything that smacks of real confiscation here, and which I assume is linked to concerns that countries will not keep their reserves in the central banks anymore. Even I find it hard to believe that the Chinese, for instance, are going to be brought on board with a proposal like this. And I, in some respects, I find it hard to believe that Western governments are actually going to embrace this idea. Am I overselling the kind of practical risks here? Sorry, that's a vague question. Perhaps Ingrid or Paul, you might help me out. I feel like so this is a legal solution to a political problem, and it works only if it solves the political problem. And I'm not sure I have a sense of why it solves that.
I agree, and I think a lot of what Paul has already said goes to this. I don't think it will solve the political problem at all, Mark. I think you've nailed it. I don't see a world in which the countries that Paul mentioned are gonna afford this legitimacy. The events in Gaza and the position of the United States in particular, but maybe Western powers in general with respect to other violations of international law I'll leave it at that. There are a lot of global political factors that I think make this really difficult. But why do we want to do it? We want to do it because political support in the US and the EU is drying up, and we want Ukraine to win the war. That's something that I very much want as well.
Yeah, underlining everything Ingrid said, I think the source of most of the resistance to the initial proposals, which had bipartisan support in the Senate, which was about just grab the money and give it to Ukraine to fund their arms effort. The Treasury Department was pretty resistant to that because it has the job of keeping the dollar as the world's, maximizing the seigniorage from the dollar. And anything we do that threatens central bank deposits undermines the value of our seigniorage. As the politics in Congress got more fraught, I think the administration was open to hearing stories about this. And I don't know, they don't talk to me about their political planning, but maybe they thought this would nudge the Republicans in the House along towards, actually giving our money to Ukraine rather than coming up with some other source of money. But I think that's the dynamic in for our domestic politics. And then internationally, I think the issue, and I don't know the answer to this question, is can we do something that the Chinese won't like, but they won't regard it as a hill they want to die on? And going through the form of a independent international tribunal that's ad hoc created for purpose might work at that, but there are absolutely no guarantees.
Me too. This is unfair, but I'm going to ask you a question. It's not unfair. It's perfectly fair. So never mind. I retract. I retract my apology. You know Lee better than any of us, and so I'm just going to impute some knowledge to you here. But I think of. So in order for this legal solution to work, it has to solve some problem of the underlying political economy, right? And you can do that with a legal solution. Maybe, you have some carve out that benefits some interest group and then they withdraw their objections and so forth. There's nothing especially complicated or fancy, but is there any problem of political economy that this solves for for Western actors? Like Treasury's not, surely they can't be enthusiastic about this, can they?
Okay, so I'm without channeling Lee, and Paul has been working more closely with Lee on this stuff, but I have worked with Lee for 25 years on various proposals. And one thing that I can say is that he doesn't, unlike us academics, he doesn't write anything that doesn't have a realistic chance of working within the existing political structure. And this project has the Leap Singh as a co-author. I do not think that somebody as high up in the national security apparatus is participating, and I'm just making this shit up, but I don't think he is participating without some significant set of sort of hand signals, smoke signals from the US government. And let's just say the rumors are that every Western government that would be involved in this syndicated loan is taking it very seriously. And here, okay, I can say more than rumors because I have emails in my inbox asking about this. So reading the proposal on its own, I would think this is a no-go. This is just smoke and mirrors. It's basically just saying, let's just take their shit. And we didn't want to do it before. Why is this going to work? But it is working, and it working in the sense that people are taking it damn seriously. But I'm going to turn the question. I know Paul has a long history of understanding these political dynamics. Paul, is this just a bullshit academic proposal of the type that we write our entire careers and nobody pays attention to? Or can this really move the needle? And Ingrid, I'd love to know your thoughts too, because you know about the pragmatic realities of politics. And then after your answers, we'll close because I've already pushed us over time.
So my thought is this, that the focus is principally on US politics, although maybe, you know, overcoming some of the German squeamishness about doing anything might be a secondary objective, but I think it's really meant to solve a US political problem. And the idea is putting it within a structure where a doctrine of self-help is applicable, satisfies Treasury's concerns. Treasury would prefer not to do anything at all, but, you know, if you are doing something that looks like a customary practice as opposed to something that looks like an act of war, which outright seizure would be, you know, Treasury, I think, would not object as strongly. And of course, they are part of the same team. They want to help there. And on the one hand, the only thing on offer from Congress, which is the White House Graham Repo Act, is pretty unacceptable, including to Republicans, some Republicans in the Senate, as well as many in the House, because it's simply grab the money and give it to Ukraine. And this looks more finessed, and there's a plausible legal story behind it. And I think the fundamental point is everything except coming up with the loan money itself is easily done without any existing additions to statutory authority. So Congress is out of the picture.
My perception of this is that Lee's proposal is meant to solve largely U.S. domestic problems. There may be a secondary goal of stiffening the German spine, but I'm not sure that's even feasible. So what are the U.S. political problems? Well, basically, there's lots of deadlocks in Washington that make new statutory authority very unlikely. And within the Biden administration, there is strong support to do something for the Ukrainians, to get them money somehow. And I think the Treasury may regard, an outright confiscation as a red line, as well as most people believe, most sensible people believe that would be illegal under domestic law. And what the Buchheit proposal does is map a path to getting money currently banked in or frozen, managed by OFAC, into the hands of the Ukrainians without new statutory authority. And there are several steps in that path that are not clear legal steps, but there are at least plausibly legal and are maybe plausible enough to meet the resistance, particularly inside the administration. I think the only really difficult issue is where do we get the capital to fund the loan? But the idea of creating a reparation right that can be set off against our duty to the Russians ultimately to refund their frozen assets, I think that's a reasonable step. I would regard that as a 60% likely win were it ever tested in court. And that's probably good enough for the current transactions. And it might even keep, you know, the Chinese and the Indians and the Brazilians from going crazy about it. They won't like it, but we don't want them to like it. We just want them not to make a big deal about it.
Wow. Okay. So I know many of our listeners don't know Paul as well as I do. I've known him forever and owe him sort of much of my academic career for helping me. But one thing I know about Paul, apart from his incredible generosity, is how careful he is and how many times he has told me that ideas that I've thrown out are just academic bullshit. So when Paul says 60%, one should listen. Ingrid, do you think this solves the political problem that I thought was going to kill it right off the bat? What's your bottom line? This or, I mean, some of the other proposals that are just, you know, take all the assets and use them as collateral, I don't see as really solving very much. That's just like taking the assets. But what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think it's one of the difficulties here is that some of the larger scale risks are really hard to evaluate and involve a lot of potentially different views about foreign policy. So, I mean, I think the risk is not so much an immediate sort of reciprocity that all of a sudden, you know, at time one, a bunch of countries, you know, remove their central bank assets from the U.S. and so on. I think the risk is, you know, even if maybe China and Russia and Brazil are going to make a big deal about it, maybe they aren't, but they're already trying to develop their own currency. There are already a variety of ways in which the global financial system, which has been incredibly beneficial to the United States, you know, is increasingly fragmented. You know, how far would these measures push those developments to the ultimate detriment of the United States? I think people just differ on how real they think the threat of de-dollarization is. It's very hard which problem you're trying to solve. It's really difficult on the international front to know whether this proposal solves it. I would put myself in the no category, but that's a different set of issues than the domestic political ones.
Thank you both so much. This has easily been for me the most fun podcast I think we have ever done. The issues are so important, and you both know so much and are so thoughtful about how to think through these difficult questions that matter a lot for the world. I'll just close by saying that for me, having worked on things like refugee claims by very powerless communities, claims that you think surely exist under international law, but will never be paid off because the countries that owe the claims are too powerful, and that the really powerful countries don't really see any mechanism of forcing payment. This particular set of strategies that some of the smartest minds in the world are now thinking of in the Ukrainian context has the potential for creating solutions to big and wide-reaching problems that we haven't really exerted the effort to figure them out. So that's my personal take. And I think your interventions, Ingrid and Paul, have been incredibly helpful and valuable. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for being our friends for such a long time over the years. And thank you for coming on our podcast.
Agreed. Thanks to you both.
Thank you both.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.